And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
There was a time, billions and billions of years ago, when there was no planet Earth. The universe was a swirl with stars and planets. Then there was an Earth, locked in orbit around the Sun, itself just a small player in the majesty of the Milky Way. And then there was life, bipods and trilobites, sponges and more. And then, well, the story goes on. But so does the debate as to what was behind all of this. Today, we're heading into the realms of evolution and the war with intelligent design. When your voice of the Earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News, and now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's a topsy-turvy world in many ways. As American troops battle to bring the right for Iraqi citizens to believe whatever religion they want, or no religion at all, in the name of democracy, here at home, a war is raging that is forcing religion into what was supposed to be sacrosanct, not only the grand halls of science, but the halls and science classrooms of our public schools. The push for inclusion of intelligent design in biology classes is causing quite a debate. Kansas just passed a law requiring intelligent design to be conjectured in their public schools. What's your take on this? Today, I've brought in someone uniquely qualified to have an opinion. Wendy Holtkamp is an evolutionary biologist, and she is a Christian. How does she see this debate? We'll find out after the news. She'll continue into our second segment, then we're up to the far northwest to learn about the North Cascades Institute, where you can go to learn about butterflies and eagles doing fieldwork, bring your family to a beautiful new lodge in the High Cascades with breathtaking views, and even get a master's degree in nature education. It's all coming up on this late 2005 edition of the Wild Side News. So put an extra log into your wood stove, pour up a fresh refill of Java, settle back, and take another audio adventure into the wonders of the realm. And so, the news. The mysteries of nature are endless. One that has baffled scientists for many years is that most unusual protuberance on a narwhal's head that can often reach 8 feet and more in length. The long tusk, which is much like a giant tooth, was hard to explain. However, Harvard School of Dental Medicine researcher Dr. Martin Nguia reported that his team discovered that the narwhal's tusk is filled with millions of nerves, which reach the surface and create an extremely sensitive appendage. It is speculated that, therefore, the narwhal would use such for discriminating a variety of oceanic conditions, including temperature, salinity, contaminants, and more. It also may explain the narwhal male's habit of rubbing tusks, which would generate quite a sensation, literally. The narwhal are among the rarest of whales, reaching 13 to 15 feet in length, and found mostly in the Arctic Ocean waters of Canada, but as far east as Russia. Good news for planet Earth. Remember the shadow that covered California's Million Solar Roof Initiative and killed it? Well, the sun is shining again, as state energy regulators on Tuesday unveiled what could be the nation's most ambitious program to expand solar power, proposing to offer more than $3 billion in consumer rebates over the next decade. The plan is essentially the same as Governor Schwarzenegger had proposed, which provides rebates to homes, businesses, farms, schools, and other public buildings that install rooftop solar panels. Bernadette Del Chiaro, clean energy advocate for Environment California, declared that with rising energy prices and continued air pollution, this is exactly the kind of landmark initiative California needs. From this, we're going to see cleaner air, affordable solar energy, and California regaining its leadership in solar power. This puts California on the fast track to catch up and even surpass Germany and Japan as the world's leading solar-powered region. Maybe this time, it will actually succeed. And in Washington, House Republicans have dropped a provision in budget legislation that would have allowed the sale of public lands for mining. Many Western senators had criticized that provision, which would have overturned an 11-year-old congressional ban that prevents mining companies from buying public land at cheap prices if the land contains mineral deposits. Nevada Representative Jim Gibbons, author of the mining legislation, revised the provision Monday in an attempt to gain Western support. The new version dropped language that would have allowed the direct sale of some lands that no longer contained minerals. However, on Tuesday, Gibbons said it was clear that even the revised provision would not make it through the Senate, where some senators had threatened to use parliamentary maneuvers to block it. Score one big one for our side. But don't get too elated. Meanwhile, the U.S. Forest Service Tuesday proposed rules to allow certain small oil and natural gas drilling projects in national forests and grasslands without requiring lengthy environmental reviews. The policy change would speed approval of drilling permits on federal leases, bringing oil and gas to market more quickly. But the legislation would also result in road cuts, drilling rigs, and pipelines in areas still being protected by environmental protections. Under the proposed rules, an energy company's exploration plan would be excluded from the normal environmental review process as long as the project did not involve more than 1 mile of new road construction or road reconstruction, 3 miles of new pipeline, or exceed 4 drill sites. Comments are being taken via email at, okay, get ready, this is a long one, ogcatex at Let's try again. ogcatex@contentanalysisgroup.com. Let's try from the start here and spell it. O-G-C-A-T-E-X at contentanalysisgroup.com. One long word. And that's the news. So now, evolution and intelligent design. I'm always looking around for interesting stories, and I came across one recently. And having lived in New Mexico for 25 years around the Santa Fe area, one of my absolute favorite places, filled with power and mystery and majesty and wonder, is an area outside of Santa Fe called Abiquiu, which is where the legendary artist Georgia O'Keeffe lived and painted. What attracted me was a story of a woman who happens to be a biologist and is at this point working on her PhD, who decided to go kind of head off into a very rustic situation out on that area and write about it, because she also is a nature writer. And her name is Wendy Holtkamp, and she's joining us now from her home in Houston. Wendy, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
You grew up, you had a unique opportunity growing up in Oregon to be raised in a very rustic situation, and I'd like to explore that to some extent to give people a sense of how it is that you came to this relationship with nature.
My dad grew up in Los Angeles, and he decided to, you know, it was time, it was the early 70s, and he wanted to just take off and start, you know, to give the kids, his, you know, I have a brother, to give us something different than he thought the city could offer. So he went off in search of some land, bought 24 acres of land in the forest in Oregon, built his own log cabin, and we lived there with no running water, we had kerosene lanterns, we heated the water on the wood stove, showered from a bucket, raised our own food, chickens and vegetables, and so it really, it was a great childhood. It really, you know, I ran around and my toys were tree knots and playing with Tonka trucks in the dirt. So sort of a different lifestyle than somebody, you know, who maybe grew up more in the city. So,
well, 70s is a pretty contemporary era. So to what degree were you aware that you were living this very unique lifestyle?
That's a good question. I don't think I really thought twice about it because, you know, that was just the way it was. And my parents were divorced, so my mom lived in a, you know, an apartment complex, and I kind of split time between the two of them. At one point, my dad won custody of me, and I actually went and lived with him full time for a while. And, you know, I think as a child, you don't really ponder, at least I didn't that much. That was just the way it was, and I loved it. I loved, you know, running around outside and playing in the garden and picking huckleberries, and that definitely, as I, later in life, I went back and lived with my mom in suburbia, and then I kind of got into that whole culture in high school, and it wasn't until when I was in college, I went to Australia to study rainforest ecology, that I kind of came back to my roots, and I saw, wow, this is really what I love. I need to be more in tune with nature again. So it was kind of a coming back to what I knew from my youth. So,
right. You, however, have integrated fairly fully into the realms of urban living. You've also been going to school for quite a bit. You have a master's degree in wildlife biology or ecology, and as well evolutionary biology. Mm-hmm. And now you're working on your PhD.
Yep.
And we're going to talk about a book that you have coming up that's going to address some of the issues. You like, the name of the book is called Fish Wars.
Right.
And this really starts to address some of the issues that are so prevalent right now concerning evolution and intelligent design. But before we get to that, which is certainly fascinating, let's also talk about what drove you to decide to, was it Abiquiu that you ended up in?
Yes, the Abiquiu was the nearest town, but the cabin was actually about 5-10 miles outside of Abiquiu. It's near a place called Owl Mountain, and just the Red Rock Hills in New Mexico. It was pretty isolated. I just did a search online for writer's retreats and, you know, researched all types of different places I could kind of get away from my suburban lifestyle for a while and just retreat into nature the way Thoreau did, working on my book proposal, and Owl Mountain won out. So I think maybe it called to me because it was so similar to my childhood. You know, it was a log cabin. It was a single room like the log cabin I grew up in. It had solar panels, so I was monitoring my solar energy intake and, you know, propane stove. And it actually wasn't quite as rustic as the place I grew up in, but it was just really, you know, there was an outhouse, and it was just really a return to nature, and I fell in love with New Mexico. It was absolutely beautiful.
So what happened as you transitioned back into this this very singular, rustic connection with the earth?
Now, it was interesting because, you know, living here in our daily life, you know, we're bombarded with email, with things to do, and, you know, I got back there. I'm a single mom, so their dad took them for a couple weeks over Thanksgiving, and it was just really a joyful time going back to nature and being alone. You know, I remember some of my friends were like, don't get lonely, but, you know, for me, being alone is really, I really enjoy it, and, you know, you can be alone with your thoughts, and I could, you know, just contemplate the mountain, and really it helped me just focus on my writing, so it was really great. I was very happy during that time.
If you could name two stellar insights that may have developed, what might they be?
One of the things that, you know, I remember thinking as I went hiking up and I was dangling my legs over a cliff there, over a ledge, and just thinking about, you know, just how beautiful the land was and what it must have been like, you know, when thousands of buffalo were there. And I, you know, I felt a little bit sad for what we've done to the earth, and I just, you know, prayed and hoped that people would start to wake up and realize that, you know, we really need to take care of the earth and that it really is a, you know, precious resource. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things. And the other was just, you know, just with regard to my book, it really helped me bring the whole idea of, you know, what I was doing was to help bring truth to society, to our culture. I believe that intelligent design is something that is bringing people away from truth, both spiritual and, you know, material truths about the natural world. So, it, you know, in writing the book, I hope to kind of open people's eyes and say, this is really what this is about, and, you know, there's no reason why evolution and Christianity have to conflict. they're not necessarily two different worldviews.
But most everybody understands the basic tenets of evolution, that is, that there is change through time based on natural selection, Darwin's theory, etc. And science has fairly well totally embraced that with variations and change. But intelligent design is a new creation. Why don't you give people a background on what that really means?
Basically, intelligent design, and I'll say at the outset, my background is in evolutionary biology. I wouldn't consider myself actually an expert in intelligent design because I think that intelligent design tries to be a scientific theory. It calls itself a theory when, in fact, very few, if any, scientific peer-reviewed publications have come out from intelligent design. I argued, that it's more of a political movement to try to oppose evolution. And so, essentially, intelligent design proponents are trying to look for the so-called fingerprints of a creator, of a designer in nature through various means. And there's a few key scientists that are promoting this through the Discovery Institute, which is based in Washington. So, but, where I'm coming at this book from is I am both a Christian and an evolutionary biologist. They don't have to conflict. Now, intelligent design is this new, wedge that's trying to come in and say evolution is an enemy of Christianity. Well, that's not a new thing from the church, but it's sort of a flare-up. Intelligent design is actually not new. It actually started back with William Paley over 100 years ago. But it was discredited as evolution became scientifically acceptable. But some people that started the Discovery Institute decided, well, really, I want to, take this concept, coin the term intelligent design, and promote it through, basically, they built a think tank, they got a lot of support, and it seems to me it's just snowballing, and to me it's a little bit scary. I taught biology for a few years, and my students, I would ask them at the beginning of the semester, what do you think evolution means? And they would say, it means that humans evolved from apes. You said most people understand evolution. There's a famous quote that says, everyone thinks they understand evolution. But in reality, I don't think a lot of people really do know what evolution says.
I think that's a really good point. That I think you're right, that a lot of people would say that evolution means that we evolved from apes. That's right, yeah.
And not only is that a misconception because there was a common ancestor, there's the evolution of all of life. It's not just humankind. And in fact, that's what a lot of people are most opposed to, but evolution is so much more complex. So I would then teach the unit, and at the end of the semester, I would say, well, what do you think of evolution now? Do you think there's enough evidence to support it? Do you think, inevitably they would say, wow, it's a lot more complex than I thought. There really is quite a bit of evidence, fossil evidence, genetic code, developmental similarities between all vertebrates, skeletal system similarities, and they would, some of them still would say, well, I still don't want to believe it. But the point was they would still do well on the test, they would understand the concepts, and that came down to they understood that evolution is a lot more complex than is being represented or than they may hear from their pastors or their parents or the public. So I think one of the things I want to do in my book is just say, okay, evolution 101, this is the basics of evolution. In a chapter, and it's a lot more complex than just people evolved from apes. That's not even what it says. And then here's intelligent design 101. And then I'm going to address what is truth. And we have scientific truth and we have spiritual truth, and they're different realms.
Tell us some of the tenets, the scientific tenets of intelligent design.
There are some books out there that go point by point of why intelligent design is not science. That's not really what I'm going to address. To me, I'm more interested in these are the basics of intelligent design, and I'm just at the outset of, I've been involved with, these issues in supporting evolution education, but what I know is that evolution is a scientific consensus, and intelligent design is not. It is something that was started by a fringe group of people that they say that this is a scientific theory, which is ironic that they call it a theory because it's just starting out, and so really it's a hypothesis. Until it's been tested and studied, and they have some peer-reviewed scientific publications behind them, then it's really nothing more than just a fringe idea. What they've done, though, is they've taken their, what they call a scientific concept, and they've politicized it by pushing it in the media and in the churches, and they've gotten people to think that, well, let's teach this as science, let's teach the controversy, but science is not a democracy. You can't vote gravity in or out of existence. You can't decide what you want to teach as science. So all I'm arguing in this book is that intelligent design is not science. It's a more of a religious concept. It's something, and you're right about the age of the Earth. There are some young Earth creationists that believe that the Earth was less, you know, between 6 and 10,000 years old. Most intelligent design proponents accept that the Earth is far more ancient than that. Some of them accept change within species. So, in effect, some intelligent design proponents, as I understand it, accept natural selection. They just don't accept macroevolution, the evolution of novel features such as limbs. So, you know, it's funny that you say, well, what are the concepts that intelligent design want, you know, scientifically are saying? And really, it's so mixed. It's, you know, what I call propaganda, because they're taking something, calling it science, but they're really trying to push more of a religious concept. And they're trying, you know, scientists don't take their ideas and promote them and do a public relations or marketing campaign to get them accepted or taught.
I know that some of my exposure to intelligent design concepts, it's almost as if the scientific proof is that the complexity of nature is unexplainable through evolution, and therefore it proves that there must have been an intelligence behind the design. I don't know if you can prove science by saying something is impossible, because impossibilities have been proven possible throughout all of science for a long time.
Right, sort of the God of the gaps.
That's exactly right. You also, besides being an evolutionary biologist and a wildlife ecologist and working on your PhD, as well are a practicing Christian. One of your efforts in writing the book is to indicate that these two concepts really shouldn't be at war, that as a matter of fact, there's much that can bring them together. Help us understand that.
It's interesting. I didn't exactly grow up in a religious household, but I did actually accept, you know, Jesus Christ at a very young age. I remember praying. In college, I learned about evolution as I became, you know, studied to earn my degree in wildlife ecology. And it is a beautiful theory. I absolutely, you know, was fascinated with it and, you know, came to my faith later. And I'm very glad that I wasn't burdened with this idea that evolution was some type of enemy of faith. And so when I came to my faith, it was sort of a non-issue. I never really bothered me, and when I read the Bible later, like I said, I believe I accepted Christ when I was a child, came away from the faith and came back to it about 10 years ago. So when I started reading Genesis, I mean, I remember thinking before I actually read it that it was, you know, very hypocritical, and I'd read it and I would be like, oh, this is a bunch of garbage. But I read it and I was actually quite amazed that, you know, it didn't say anything that I thought was too outlandish. I think it's actually quite remarkable that the order of the creation account roughly follows what we know about evolution. I think it's interesting that Adam was formed from the dust of the earth, and in fact, that's what evolution, you know, the origin of life, ultimately we came from organic, from non-organic matter, and amino acids were then formed, which formed DNA. So if you think of it, there's actually a number of different ways that evolutionary biologists that are Christians, and there are quite a few of them, reconcile the faith. And I think ultimately we have to have some humility, because there's a lot of mysteries that we will never know, you know, this side of heaven with absolute certainty what the answer is. And so we have to say, well, this is the best that science can do. This is the way we understand the world. This is what the Genesis account says. And it, you know, it does not affect my faith.
So how does this then play out in terms of the debate? If you were to address intelligent design advocates as well as, let's say, in a church setting, how would you make your case?
Well, I think the most important thing is that people understand what science is and that it's testing truths in the material or natural world. Now, there's natural and there's supernatural. There's physical and there's metaphysical. And spiritual truths are in a different realm. And that's not to say there's not some evidence of faith working in our life, but science, you know, Stephen Jay Gould likes to call them non-overlapping magisteria. There's the realm of science, and it tests things in the natural world by definition. And then there's spiritual truths, and there's faith, and that is simply a different realm of existence. You can't, and I believe this is where intelligent design fails as a faith-based concept, and that is that they're trying to test with science for God. And to me, it's almost, you know, arrogance. You know, why doesn't that negate faith? Why should we test for God? Do we need evidence of God? Isn't that what faith is all about?
I am a biologist myself, and I went through a very similar type of experience as you. It's a sort of a linear correlation in the sense that by the time I got to college, although I had been raised in a Christian faith, I too began to be quite an agnostic, and I don't know that I was an atheist per se, but I certainly began to suggest, I can recall making a commentary that I just didn't believe that there was some sort of gaseous vertebrate, otherwise known as God, hanging out somewhere in the heavens who administered everything. And that was my belief, and I don't even know how I would respond to that similar type of concept now. But there is something about science, and there is something about studying biology, that does tend to bring one away from a belief in God, and perhaps that's part of the challenge, is that those within the Christian faith are afraid that although they raise their children as Christians, that the process of discussing evolution may bring them away from that.
Actually, I think this is really interesting because I think that Scott Peck, author of the best-selling The Road Less Traveled, I think he's probably my favorite author, one of the most brilliant people I know of. And I think he explains this culture war to a T, and in fact, I'm going to address some of this in my book. And he talks about how there's four different stages of spiritual growth. And in the second stage, people, it's sort of an institutional stage where people like the status quo and rules. And, you know, I think that there are some religious people that have, that, you know, are sort of in a, you know, with all due respect, they like, you know, their faith is handed down to them. And then when people start to question, and what Peck says is that he didn't understand it because people would come to him in therapy, and if they were Christian, they would become atheists. And if they're atheists, they would become of some sort of faith. And he didn't understand it until he understood that what was happening was the people that were very religious, that were stuck in sort of a rule-based way of thinking, then started questioning. And a lot of these people, you know, the stage three is what he calls the materialistic. And these are scientists, not all scientists, there are some scientists who accept faith, but a lot of humanists are in this stage, and they're actually more, according to Peck, more spiritually advanced than certain people that are in the stage two institutional. And then there's the stage four, in which this group of people, we call them mystical, accept both the scientific worldview and the spiritual worldview, and they're comfortable with paradox. And so people that maybe didn't have a faith at that point, or really they put their faith in science and what they could see about the natural world, then started to see, well, wow, maybe there is actually a different realm. Maybe there is some sort of spiritual realm as well as what we can study about the natural world. So I think that that's very interesting. So I think you see these warring factions between religion and science, when some of the scientists are actually, in an ironic sense, spiritually more mature than, or spiritually more developed than some of the people that are stuck in the, this is the way it has to be, we have to think. You know, and one of the things he says is that people will go to great lengths to fight against this thing that they don't understand, and this is true both in individual psychotherapy and, you know, in our culture, that people ultimately expend more effort fighting against a new reality than it would take to actually incorporate that new reality into their understanding of the world.
There's more to be said about this debate. We continue with Wendy Holtkamp following this short break, just long enough to refill the Java. Then it's back with more of your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.